Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Just before I go to the front pages, actually, Father Iggy O'Donovan is on our panel this morning. Iggy, that's a shocking, shocking tragedy in Donegal. Young people out in the fine weather. A lot of people were out and about, I'd say, enjoying the water and all that kind of thing. It's hard to know what to say, isn't it?
It's very difficult to know what to say. The moment I heard it, I thought of Chrysla, the tragedy they had there the last couple of years, that awful tragedy.
Yeah.
But for the immediate family, like any word one would use now, are almost sound like useless cliches. Okay, your sympathy, your prayers, say what you like. But for somebody in my position, anyway, the happenings of this sort, they sort of throw us back on ourselves, whether we're religious believers or not. You know, to explain innocent suffering and those poor lads who went out yesterday for the swim in the little bit of sunshine we get, and to end like that, it's beyond belief. And we can only pray to be delivered from that type of thing, that presence of innocence, it seems to be woven into our very existence as human beings. I think it was Brothers Karamazov, one of them, said at one time that our earth seems to be saturated in tears from the earth, from the crust to the core, and it was one of the reasons he found it difficult to believe, actually, in the divine. But I'm not going into that now, but clearly our love and sympathy to the families there. I know that sounds very almost hollow, but it's as much as I'm able to say.
Yeah. But look, and I think the fact that they know that those families and those communities know that everybody is thinking of them and with them today, as you say, some small hollow comfort, but there is no comfort for sure. Okay, let's have a look at the front pages. So the front page of the Sunday Times are saying US tariffs mean a tighter budget, ministers told. Ministers have been warned to curtail their budget demands and amid increasingly pessimistic economic predictions and further tariff-related trade volatility. And that's before we even get to tax changes, which I think generally is agreed could be an even bigger issue for us. The Business Post is leading with, so you know this guy, Dr. Sean Sweeney, who's a mega project engineer who has been brought in to do the Metrolink, and he's famously on $500,000 a year. So he's given an interview to the Business Post, and I think some people might find it refreshing. He's from New Zealand, so he's saying things like, I deliver what I call nation-building projects. You leave the country better off, but some people get grievously impacted. And so he's saying that's just how it is. He's saying these things on average come in 40% over cost. He says, like, these are just too big for human beings to see that far over the horizon, these kind of projects, he says. He won't give a date. He says, any date I give you and we sign up major contractors, just an estimate. And on that, he's kind of saying, I don't know if we'll get a building company either, because, and he says, if we don't, we're dead in the water. Apparently, there are a lot of these projects going around the world, and Ireland is not seen as an attractive place to do them. He says, I noticed as soon as I got here, things take longer, and it's not a simple answer. So that's him. We'll come back to that. The Sunday Independent is leading with the Scots row. Camogie boss issues new plea in scramble to fix Scots row. So they have two things here. The former president of the GAA, Sean Kelly, has urged that the players should be allowed to play in shorts. And in a move to end the crisis, Camogie Association President Brian Malloy has issued a special Congress note sent to all clubs and secretaries, and he's saying that it is very important that the voice of the player is heard and listened to and that players are reflected in the vote. The Mail is leading on a story about a Garda whistleblower related to the murder of Detective Garda Colm Horgan. And the Mirror is leading with ex-pilot's 10 million drug charge. A former Ryanair pilot has been charged with possession of 10 million euros worth of drugs. So our panel this morning, Lisa Chambers is a former Fianna Fáil Seanad leader, now head of public affairs at Concello. Ellen Coyne is a special correspondent for the Irish Independent. Dan O'Brien is chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and a columnist with The Currency. And Father Iggy O'Donovan, you've heard, is an Augustinian priest. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So Ellen Coyne, you're practicing Catholic,
loose interpretation of the word, but
and you've written a lot about your faith and all that kind of thing. What do you think of the new Pope?
I thought it was excellent. I think it was a really heartening moment on Thursday when we finally got the white smoke and learned that Father Robert Prevost, as he was formerly known, now known as Pope Leo XIV, is going to be the new leader of the Catholic Church. He's really interesting for a number of reasons. He's under the age of 70, which is young for a pope. He's the first American pope, technically, although I know he's kind of being claimed now as a South American pope, which would be seen
An Irish pope as well.
Yeah, sure,
we'll claim anyone as well.
So he's kind of seen in that sense to be a continuity candidate, if you could say it that way, to Pope Francis. But I think what's really interesting about him, and it's probably an indication of the name that he chose, the last time we had a Pope Leo the 13th was over a century ago. And that pope was someone who really defined himself as being a champion for workers' rights. He had a very famous document that he published basically on capital and labour. And you can see even from the things that Pope Leo has said since he has taken up his new role, he's kind of continuing on in that
sense.
So
as a Catholic, are you excited by him?
Yes. I mean, look, we all get consumed by these discussions where we try to put political labels that we're used to, like liberal and conservative, onto the Catholic Church. And a lot of the discussion before the conclave was about that, about things like the role of women and what the church is doing in terms of its pastoral response to gay people. And those are important issues. But in the current international climate, if you have a pope who continues and picks up where Pope Benedict and Pope Francis left off on things like the response to the migration crisis, environmental issues, even the things that Pope Leo has said about AI as a threat to workers' rights, those are very progressive and they can be very radical.
Do you think it's a good tone to his papacy?
Yes,
so far,
Catholic Church can be radical when it actually doesn't change, when it sticks to long-established values that it's had for over a century.
Okay. Iggy, you actually know Pope Leo?
I did. I've known him since 1981, actually, when we were studying in Rome. He was specialising in canon law, which I tried for a little while and actually sat with him for a couple of days. Then I moved over to the history.
So he was what, in his 20s at that stage? Yeah,
yes.
Young man.
Yeah.
What was he like as a young man? Is he serious fella?
I would say, God rest my mother, she would have said he would be sensible.
Okay.
Hard-working student, always top of the class. He'd already come through Villanova University in America, an Augustinian university, which we associate with sport in this country. He'd come through that and had a degree, I think a first honours in mathematics.
Right.
And then to Rome, where he specialised in canon law, and while I was doing the history. So we would have known each other very well. We would have dined together, come and gone together. No, he wasn't my personal buddy. Like, I had a lot better friends than him. But we would have known each other over the years. He went on to become then the head of the Augustinian order, and visited Ireland many times in that capacity. And I had a working in Drogheda during that period, and he got in touch with me once or twice about whatever. And
not in a good way. I'm
well, sort of, like, he was responsible for the everyday running of the order, and sometimes things would arrive on his desk about, you know, what's happening out in the local common, so to speak.
Okay, yeah.
And party.
Troublesome,
you know,
priests, like.
Yes,
yeah.
But I always got on very well with him, and he never sanctioned me or anything like that.
Okay.
But very bright. But then he moved and spent many years in Latin America, in Peru.
Yeah.
And would have worked there, certainly in a very rural, mountainous area. You'll see pictures of him on horseback. And it's not that he has interest in cool more. He hasn't. It was the mode of transport in the mountains.
I remember when I was young, the priests who'd been to South America were generally kind of, they'd be shocking the congregation in Bishopstown and Cork with kind of basically communism. Like, a lot of them became quite kind of radicalised down in that part.
They
of the world,
did, they? And there was this thing known as liberation theology, which John Paul clamped down on very much. But which was very much about going out, as Francis put it later, going out and smelling the sheep. And many of them, they saw the most, like, it was during the Cold War when we feared and we prayed for the conversion of Russia. But what they were seeing there in Latin America, South America, sponsored mainly by the United States, were the most right-wing autocratic regimes in Argentina, Chile, Peru, a lot of them. And many of them became quite radicalised there. And so Bob, as I always knew him, Bob Prevost, he has worked for many years in that situation. So he has worked at the coalface.
Okay.
So he certainly knows what's going on the ground.
When's the last time you met him?
The last time I met him was actually, this sounds very familiar, a funeral in Cork. in 2014, an Augustinian was buried in Cork, in the cemetery in Cork. And I remember afterwards going to dinner with him and other Augustinians and sitting with him at the, in the restaurant, which I don't recall the name of now, in Cork. But that was the last time I saw him in 2000.
Did he take a drink? Do you recall?
I don't recall whether he had one on that occasion, but...
I mean, I'm not being nosy, but it would be in Ireland. It's kind of a gauge for some people of a fella. Like, would he take a drink in company or?
My experience of him now, where we had met, and he'd be here for gatherings and so you know, chapters and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, we'd normally meet at night, and I would say generally very abstemious. Certainly more abstemious than I was.
Okay. Dan, you've picked Gary Murphy, Optimistic Pope Seeks a Brighter Dawn for Church. Do you think this makes a big difference in the scheme of things, a new pope?
Well, I'm not a religious person, and some non-religious people can be a little bit dismissive of religion, so I certainly don't want to be that.
No.
But in terms of the broader sort of scale of the papacy, it's very important for people of faith and Roman Catholics, etc. But in the broader scheme of things, I think you'd have to go back to Pope John Paul to see a pope who's had an influence in global affairs beyond immediate matters of faith. So overall, as sort of Stalin once dismissively said about the pope, how many divisions does he have? You know, there's no military power there. It's more a role for the those who believe in the faith.
One of the world's biggest influencers, though, 1.5 billion followers.
Well, in terms of how much influence over, you know, global affairs does a pope have, and you know, I think that they have very limited over things beyond their own area. And as I say, that's not in any way to be dismissive. Very,
I think it's a lot of people are thinking that possibly choosing a liberal American pope was in some way the hive mind saying we want to pick a kind of an antidote to Trump in some way or whatever. Lisa, you picked David Quinn's piece in the Sunday Indo, but just before we get into the detail of that, broadly your thoughts on it, does it matter, and are you excited by him?
Yeah, it absolutely matters. I think it was a historic moment. You know, when I was growing up, it was Pope John Paul. And, you know, so to see that change, I think now we have Pope Leo XIV. We could have him for 20 years plus because of his age, as Ellen pointed out. I'm kind of one of those, I think, like many people in Ireland, I was raised a Catholic. My son has been christened, but I'm not in Mass every weekend. I've struggled with that over the years. Certainly in my 20s, I was really pushing back against it. I've mellowed in my later years, if I can put it that way. And, you know, I do feel that...
But you would go to the church for the big occasions in your life and for the rites of passage, yeah?
I would go... I mean, I go for funerals probably most regularly, as not surprising. Weddings, probably at Christmas. To be honest, a lot of that is you feel like you're missing something. Maybe that's because I was raised with that. So it does... There is a vacuum there for people because there's definitely been... And that speaks to when we see the rise of the Catholic Church in other parts of the world and the decline here in Ireland and Western Europe, that we're struggling to kind of reconcile all of the bad stories. We don't need to go there today, but with some of the good stuff, you know, and there's lots of good things as well. So I'm definitely in a space of, you know, my husband has a deep faith, live and let live, and I see the benefits, but I think there's lots of issues to be worked through. And obviously the role of women as a woman, it's very hard to just turn a blind eye to that stuff.
Okay. Your husband's deep faith, does it sit okay between the two of you that he's that way and you're not? It's not.
Oh, of course, absolutely. Well, I married him, so...
Clearly,
I'm okay.
You knew
what
you were getting into.
I did. But I just think that's very normal. I think in every household in the country, there's just, we're a Catholic country, really. But there's that kind of dipping in and dipping out of it. And when I watched Pope Leo, you know, take to the balcony and give his first speech, I was waiting for him to speak in English, which he didn't do, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended by that. It was something to note. I was somewhat, not that I know him well, of course I don't, but I was somewhat relieved that, you know, in the spectrum of, and they don't like to be spoken about in terms of liberal and conservative, because it's the Catholic Church, it's conservative at its base, right? But that he wasn't more to the right, if I can put it that way. I was kind of relieved that it was somebody that is maybe continuing on a message of tolerance and looking after those that needed most in a world with so much chaos and pain and hurt. It's just a nice message. It's uplifting. And I think it was a nice day, just overall.
So Iggy, Lisa makes an interesting point there about our attitude, maybe in Ireland particularly, and some other countries particularly, to the church. It's very coloured now, obviously, by the, you know, dark chapters and absolutely terrible things that were done in this country. Is there any question that with time now, a new pope and everything, if he plays cards right, could the Catholic Church in Ireland have some kind of resurgence, or is it over, do you think, in terms of, is it now, it's now where it's going to be as a kind of...
The church as it was that I grew up in, that's over. And I don't think there'll be any coming back to that. Now, the mention of the dark things and so forth, the scandals and so forth, and this, particularly the safeguarding issue, that was a massive surgical operation carried out without anaesthetic on a patient who thought he was in good health. That has had a dreadful effect on the church. I know because I lived through it. And
When you say on the church, on the clerical church?
On the clerical church, but also so many of the foot soldiers on the ground. The level of disillusionment. But something I would say, and back to Dan mentioned Stalin and the division, how many divisions has he got? Interesting, recently, in the last couple of years, where many of us felt we were back in the 1930s, looking at Putin and looking at Trump and looking at Netanyahu and the war and the threat of war, an awful darkness. And yet, this elderly Sikh man in the Vatican, Francis, seemed to stand out as a ray of hope for decency in a world where things were so morally and politically bankrupt. And even the reaction to his illness and his death, and I'm talking about people who might see themselves as lapsed Catholics or non-Catholics or non-believers even, the number who are touched, so that it has a massive, I believe, moral influence for the good, even to make people feel a bit better about things, that it needn't be all Netanyahu and Putin. And I think that is significant. And if Leo the 14th follows through on that as a moral leader, I think that's as nearly as good as he can do. He hasn't the military might. He cannot impose tariffs. He cannot do any of that. But God, he does have a great moral following for believers, and I think even many non-believers alike. And look,
Ellen, do you think that he can have any impact on the state of the church, if we can call it that, in Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. And I think he can have a relevance on the state of the world as well. I mean, when Donald Trump woke up on Thursday, he was the most important, most famous American in the world. And by the time he went to bed that night, he had been relegated. And I think to have a pope who is the opposite of America First at a point in time when you have a particularly perverse brand of Catholicism coming out of the White House is very relevant. To bring it back to Ireland, I think that obviously the Catholic Church here does not have the influence that it had previously, which is a good thing. I think the influence that the Catholic Church has now is exactly in proportion. And I think that because of the fact that its two major interventions in politics over the course of the last decade were seen as something regressive when it was trying to stop the repeal of the Eighth Amendment or the marriage equality movement, means that it sits as a kind of weird conservative think tank in the minds of some people. But actually, the record of the Catholic Church on the most important political issue in the country, which is housing, is quite strong. If you look at the Peter McVeary Trust, the Capuchin Day Centre, and the Catholic Church has consistently been very strong against the Irish government. Bishops have said very strong things on the moral duty of them to stop the housing crisis. So I think that a Catholic Church is still relevant politically, but it's relevant in proportion in a much smaller scale.
Okay, so that when they stay out of people's bedrooms and bodies and stuff like that, that they actually do something.
There's no
work,
moral obsession with sexuality.
I know, but I suppose that at the heart of the church still is.
And I think,
Brendan,
those things are non-issues at this point, that even if tomorrow Pope Leo was to imagine, it won't happen, but ordain women, I think at the coalface at this stage, in this country certainly, it wouldn't make much difference, because so many have moved on. We're in a more existential situation now, where many, many, and I'm talking about my own friends, my own family, they've moved on so much from the church that we knew, that these things are almost, they've made up their minds about them.
Okay.
And they're not pushed whether he brings it in or not.
Okay.
It has moved on.
Lisa, speaking of our obsession with women's bodies and stuff like that, you picked the front page piece of the Sunday Independent today, Sinead Cassan and Mary Regan writing, "Camogie Boss Issues New Plea in Scramble to Fix Scorts Row." This is a very unseemly kind of conversation, really, in general, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's ridiculous, really, isn't it, in this day and age? I don't know how else best to put it. I note your own piece in the paper this morning, Brendan, about we're all becoming experts on sports, but I do feel I've amassed quite a bit of knowledge in the last few days just because it's been everywhere. It's been the story. And that, in some ways, is unfortunate, that that's the story about women's sports, because I know from my time in politics and playing Gaelic football at a young age right through my teens, that the
wearing shorts?
Absolutely wearing shorts. Now, they were white, and we've gotten past that issue as well, because there's issues there for women on that front, but that's not today's story. But just, you know, access to facilities, basic equipment, expenses for our senior players that are, you know, at the verge of being professionals, but they're not on a par with their male counterparts. These are the issues that need to be dealt with. They're the issues that should be on our front pages, that these girls should be focusing on. But instead, we have a situation where the Munster final is postponed. I mean, what an insult to those, both of those teams. They should be in the headspace of getting ready for that game, not expending any energy on fighting about whether they can wear a pair of shorts or not, because the vast majority, I think, of people would agree it's a ridiculous conversation in the first place. I will note in that piece that there are...
No, look, the last time they had a vote on it, there was it did not pass.
No, and I want to acknowledge that there are rules. There is an association, there was a process followed, and all of that was legitimate and done above board. So there are questions, I suppose, for the association to answer as to why that result did not reflect the clear views of 80%+ of the players. But I note in the paper there are concerns that the motion is not a done deal to pass in a few weeks' time. So I would certainly urge the association to make sure that motion passes.
Alan?
I mean, it's an existential question now for the Camogie Association. Like, I was talking to a friend who played at county level, and she was explaining to me that if she knew that a game was going to be televised, she would make sure she was wearing cycling shorts underneath the skirt. Like, that is so degrading, and as if that would be tolerated if it was happening in the men's Munster final. I think the fact of the matter is, you mentioned the vote that failed to pass. The people who were voting to keep the skirt, which is such a stupid, degrading word for a pseudo piece of clothing anyway, are not the people who are being forced to wear the skirt. And yes, as Lisa pointed out, in Brian Malloy's letter, which is reported on in the Sindo today, he talks about upholding the rules. I think if a rule is that stupid, it doesn't deserve any deference. And the Camogie Association in Dublin did allow games to go ahead when the players were wearing shorts, because the case against the skirt is so strong.
Now, we will note that a man, what I presume was a man, had to take note of which women were wearing skirts in those matches that went ahead.
And that's an unfair position for people to be put in. Like, I note that apart from this letter from Brian that we're reading about today, there hasn't actually been any leadership or intervention from the Camogie Association. And if and when this, we hopefully move
well,
on.
Well, no,
from
they
this.
Moved. They have moved forward.
But who's leading on this? Like, who's talking to the public? Is it being left to referees to be the ones who are getting the abuse for this issue? And the issue now for the Camogie Association is not just resolving this, but actually the questions that people are actually asking now about whether or not the Camogie Association should exist at all, or if it should be the GAA that's governing the sport.
And I think that is in train, isn't it, over the next few
years. Yeah, but it's taking too long. It's taking forever. And I think that this is a mark against the Camogie Association.
Lisa, is this also part of this? This is part of a broader thing about trying to keep girls and young women in sport as well, which is still a huge problem, isn't it?
It is. Look, I mean, boys and girls become body conscious at a certain age. We all go through that, but it seems to be more of an issue at times for girls. And the drop-off rate is much higher for girls in sport than it is for boys. I think it's 1 in 5 for girls and 1 in 20 for boys by the time they get to their teenage years. So there's a huge difference there. When Thomas Byrne was Minister for Sport, there was a rule brought in terms of sports capital funding that you had to show you were facilitating equal access for men and women. And, you know, I know from my own work on the ground, like, that really kind of put it up to clubs to say, you know, you won't get your money if you don't up your game. And they did it because there was a financial penalty if they didn't do it. So it can be done. I think, and I think it was Sean Kelly is quoted as making a point that this is dragging on now. And as we know with the negative story, the longer it goes on, the more damage is done. I'm not sure they made the right call by postponing the game, giving these couple of weeks, allowing the story and the issue to fester, upsetting the teams that were involved, and then coming back to resolve it.
Yeah, presumably if you were building up to a Munster final on Saturday, like, you know, there's a whole process around that.
But even what you're eating, your training, it's not just getting in the right headspace. It's all of the physicality that goes with it. But just the damage to the association and the game overall, we've another couple of weeks now where this is going to just roll on further damage. I mean, you just need to nip these things in the bud, deal with it, get the dead cat off the table, to bring up that famous quote. But, you know, you do need to move on quickly from these things.
It is not to blame the church for everything, but like I do think that in people's minds, like it does to some people, it slightly does have echoes of the you know the 1950s in Ireland and the church's attitude to
it has echoes of that. And of course, looking at the fact that it's the headline on the Independent today, the GAA, a huge day today. Huge matches, you know, that they're centre stage.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is the headline, it reminds me a little bit of Albert Reynolds about we're tripping up on the little things. How it has been allowed to fester and get to this point. And really doing such awful PR disaster for the GAA. That's how somebody hasn't taken it by the scruff of the neck before now. I literally don't know, but it's certainly it has been handled badly.
Yeah, not the GA, but the Camogie Association.
The Camogie Association,
people
sorry.
Know what you mean. Dan, just to finish up on this, you picked Maria Cahill's piece, I think, in the Sunday Independent, Skirting Around Skirts Fiasco, Pooh's Final Insult for Our Sportswomen.
Yeah, I thought it was a strongly worded piece, but just to echo Lisa, you know, to get it sorted, you know, it's crazy that something like this is dominating the airwaves when there's so much going on in the world. Just get it sorted.
Okay, fair enough. And Alison O'Connor, by the way, as well, I know a couple of you picked. Alison O'Connor has a tremendous piece in the Sunday Times today as well. Okay, we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Lisa Chambers, Ellen Coyne, Dan O'Brien and Father Iggy O'Donovan. Texter there says, where are the male county players in this? Have they voiced their support of the women or sports players? And someone else says, Pope Leo brings a new hope to the church. I hope he leads the church in faithful and not try to lead the world. Good point. Okay. Dan, the last time you were here, it was just before, the dark chapters of Liberation Day. And you were very depressed at that stage about the state of the world economy. I think you were likening the potential impact of the tariffs on us to what happened here in 2008. What's your overview now? Are you any bit more sanguine about things?
I'm less pessimistic, mainly because what's happened to the US, the degree of pushback, whether it's from financial markets, whether it's from businesses, political opinion polls, the way Americans are viewing what's going to happen to inflation in their country because of all this tariff crisis. Craziness. So there's been a lot of pushback against it, some pausing of things. So is it going to be as bad as it looked on Liberation Day? It doesn't look that way, which is good for us because we are so incredibly integrated into the US economy. So it is the outlook is less pessimistic. That said, you know, Ian Guider has a piece in the Business Post today focusing on the tax side of things, that if the US government really wants to take advantage of our weakness and our integration into the US economy, they have a lot of things they can do. So the tax piece, for example, if they want to change their tax laws, they could lure their pharmaceutical manufacturers back to the US, and that would be a huge hit to the Irish economy.
Okay, so and we know that will take years, like for them to move, possibly decades, with like the Catholic Church, it's turning around an ocean liner. But it could mean that new investment goes towards the US.
Well, it's hard to know because when you talk to people in the industry, it's very much a lot of this stuff is commercially sensitive. So how many companies have manufacturing facilities in Ireland that they can make the same product in the US? Now, that can happen pretty quickly if they run down production of the Irish.
So if you've excess capacity basically in the US,
they shift it over or they do another
FDA
shift
approved
or whatever.
Already. And
exactly. Yeah. So it's not that there was an element of complacency last year when I spoke to people in the pharmaceutical industry. Oh, no, it'll be fine. We got through it the last time. And then there was near panic when Trump was reelected and this all started. So I certainly, this notion that it would take many, 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 many years for any significant change to happen. The reason Ireland had this huge surge in manufacturing of pharmaceuticals going to the United States was because of a 2017 change under the previous Trump administration, which incentivized US pharmaceutical manufacturers to offshore. And they were doing that, and our exports of pharmaceuticals rose very, very, very quickly. In fact, we in just a few short years, we became the biggest importer of pharmaceuticals to the United States, bigger than Germany, bigger than Switzerland, bigger than China. So that happened quite quickly. So I just, you know,
and IP, there's no room for complacency. IP can move overnight, can it? It's the ultimate kind of liquid mobile asset.
For those products that need in the pharmaceutical and the tech sector, intellectual property, as they call it, is something that can move. People talk about exit taxes and whatever, but there is no room for complacency. If the United States chooses to get its companies out of Ireland and back into the United States, they have many, many tools. They're strong. We're weak.
Okay. So then, and look, this is the billion-dollar question, really, but just maybe you take some stab at it. Like, any idea where all of this might land at the moment? I know he's incredibly unpredictable and, you know, obviously anything could happen, but, like, we don't know yet. Are the threatened tariffs on pharma happening? Where is he going to land with China? It feels now like the UK got this great trade deal, which is basically like, you know, it's good for cars maybe and for steel potentially, but
yeah, I wouldn't overstate the UK thing. You know, these trade deals, a real trade deal is thousands and thousands of pages. It takes a long time to go through. So where will all this land? I think with China, because there is a logic for the US to decouple from China, it's its main geopolitical rival. One could easily see those two economies becoming very separated and becoming blocks, more like in the last Cold War when there was very limited contact between the Soviet Union and the United States. So I think it's very possible they could see a severe decoupling between those two economies. With Europe, as I say, I'm slightly more optimistic now. Less pessimistic, let me put it in that way, than in late March, on the basis that there has been so much domestic pushback in the United States. This is just not a good idea. It affects Americans in terms of inflation, in terms of accessing Christmas toys. There are so many downsides to this with so few upsides.
So you would be hopeful of a reasonable deal with Europe, but that presumably is still going to mean 10% tariff seems to be the baseline.
Oh, that seems to be the baseline. And then what the big uncertainty is, the degree to which Europe will certainly retaliate. Okay, there's no doubt about that. Europe has made a decision there will be retaliation. What sort of retaliation remains to be seen? There's a four-week period. The European Commission came out this week listing potential retaliation. The member states will come together over the next 4 weeks and decide what that is. Then they will, if there isn't a deal with the US, there will be retaliation. And then the big question will be, does Trump decide to come at us again? And do we get into a cycle? If he says, accepts our retaliation, and then we have these tariffs on both sides, which are bad for Ireland, bad for Europe, bad for everyone, if we have them, and it rests at that, at least businesses can get used to these barriers. Some businesses won't be able to do business on those with those tariffs, but at least we'll have some certainty.
Okay.
But if he goes counterattacks, then we're into another cycle, and that's really bad.
Okay, so one more question then. And I know a lot of people are talking about like there being what you might call an air bubble in not just in the American economy, no, but in all economies. Hiring decisions being put off, investment decisions being put off, and that will all kind of, but I know that your key metric a lot of the time, Dan, for Main Street, if you will, is employment, and that's where it'll affect the reality of most people's lives. So in 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, do you see that we're possibly going to have an unemployment problem? Do you think we're going to have an actual squeeze on people's living standards?
If this triggers a recession, then naturally we're going to see that all recessions almost always lead to higher unemployment. And that's going to be the big question.
Chances of a recession right now?
I'd say it's 50-50. Given certainly from the US side of things and then how that feeds across to the European side. But I would put it at 50-50.
Okay. Ellen, you picked the front page of the Sunday Times, and this is again back to how it will affect us. US tariffs means tighter budget, ministers told.
Yeah, so Jennifer Bray has a report on the front page of the Sunday Times today, and the language that's being used apparently with ministers is things like they're being told to prioritise, that choices will have to be made, that the first budget of this new government is going to be very different to previous budgets that we've seen. And when I was reading that report, the alarm bell that started ringing in my head was the €200 childcare promise that was made during the election by almost everybody. But yeah. I think it was the one election promise that kept being repeated to me by what I describe as like normal people, people who don't work in journalism and politics.
Okay.
Simon Harris had promised that that was going to be, that he would move on that in the first budget of this new government. I know that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael canvassed separately, but he did also say in November that there would be an action plan on the childcare promise within the first 100 days of government. Obviously, we've passed that without it. And the National Women's Council of Ireland was active on this last week, asking where that promise is. I think if the government doesn't move on that, they're going to be in big trouble.
Can I ask you a question? How much has happened on childcare? I'm a bit out of that world now, but like, I mean, has it been cut by 20? It was going to be cut like by 25% and 25% successively. Has childcare, what I'm trying to ask you in a really awkward way, has childcare in the real world come down dramatically in price?
So the figure that you were citing there under the last government under Roderick O'Gorman was an average figure, so everybody's will be different, but I know that mine didn't change very much. It's still well north of €800 a month, which is a lot. And Roderick O'Gorman was kind of talking about how this was impacting people's family planning destiny, that people were putting off having second and third children because of the childcare issue. I think when you think about the relationship between the public and the government, if they don't move on this, they are going to be in huge trouble, because the promise that they made was so captivating. Like, people thinking about €200 would literally be life changing for most household budgets if the childcare bill was capped at that. So for to come out on that promise so strong, okay, and I know they were all making it, to not deliver it, there's huge.
OK, so everyone talking about housing as the big issue. You think that could be a real flashpoint. Lisa, in your new life, are you dealing with multinationals in Ireland and that kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And tariffs is on everybody's minds. And, you know, there's been a big focus on the pharma sector, and you know, Ireland's been in the crosshairs, and we've been mentioned quite regularly by the US administration. But actually, for every industry and sector, what they're watching is the overall health of the Irish economy. Is it a good place to invest? Will my investment, you know, pay off long term? So there's definitely a wait and see approach. It's having maybe a little bit of a chilling effect. People just holding back to see, you know, is this going to be a long term thing? Definitely feel that, you know, with those in the pharma and tech sector, medtech sector, it's not as panicked as it was at the outset. It's calmed a little bit. I think the view is that this is not going to be as bad as Dan said, as we initially thought it might be. But in saying that, there was a very good paper published by the ESRI and the Department of Finance in March of this year, so very recent. And it kind of scenario plans the different levels of tariffs between 10% and 25%. So if you really want to dig into what the potential impact might be on the Irish economy, that's a good place to go. But the bottom line there is that with a unilateral tariff, so just the US levelling tariffs on the EU, there's an impact to our economy. If we retaliate, that impact gets worse. But if we don't retaliate, then there's nothing to incentivise the US to come to the table. So I would agree we will retaliate if they don't come to the table. But this month-long process that we're in now, we've got this list of sectors that the EU are proposing retaliation in terms of tariffs. There is concern in Ireland around aircraft and bourbon, yeah, being in there, because that could impact Irish whiskey, for example. Big concerns there. So we have a month now to engage at an EU level, and that's the mechanism we have to work through. There is
okay,
no back and
so,
forth.
And I don't want to lose people too much in the details of that process. Can I ask you what I asked Dan? So from your current job and from your experience as a politician, do you see unemployment coming down the line? Do you see a fall in people's standards of living coming down the line in the next few years?
Yeah, I think if we get into a full-blown trade war and we have tariffs hit back at the US and then they come back and hit us again, it's going to have an impact on jobs. I think job creation, the Minister for Finance has been very clear. He thinks maybe upwards of 80,000 jobs could be lost if this...
Or could not be created.
Could not be created.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there's an impact if you don't have continued investment or companies scale back, you're going to have a drop-off in income tax, corporation tax, people's feeling of being able to spend, they become,
yeah,
more conservative.
So yeah,
just all of that kind, yeah, of trickles on. So I do think, okay, there is a potential impact there. There is a wait-and-see approach. I think the government are doing the right things in terms of being cautious in the next budget. Now, I would caveat that by saying it probably suits the Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure to tell their colleagues, you know, don't get ahead of yourselves, have a more refined list of asks, because,
yeah,
demand will always exceed resources, no matter,
yeah,
how,
yeah,
good things,
okay,
are.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of managing expectations there as well.
I could one little comment there.
Yeah.
Sorry. For someone with more otherworldly interests, I noticed something last week which wasn't commented upon much, and it was the Senate hearing in Washington for the new American ambassador to Ireland.
Yeah.
Normally that would be waved through as a minor job, but I noticed he was quizzed very heavily, and not quizzed by just anybody, but by Marco Rubio,
yeah,
Rubio, major figure, who again and again came back to our attitude to Palestine and Israel and so forth and emphasised it, that the ambassador had to sort us out on this one. And I noticed today there were a couple of articles in that very thing which could have economic implications.
We could start seeing the cost of our principles.
Matt Cooper today in the Business Post is talking about the economic implications for us if we're caught up in the Middle East, and particularly if we're seen by the Americans as being unfriendly to their friends. And we are getting that name. But what struck me was that somebody as senior as Marco Rubio, why would he give a damn about ambassador to Ireland? But his emphasis was, you got to sort these guys out on Palestine. He spoke of our anti-Semitism and so forth. That is significant.
Yeah.
Much so that Matt Cooper writes about it today, as do others.
Okay. Now, this Metro bus on the front, the new Metro bus on the front of the Business Post. Ellen, tell us about him.
He's a breath of fresh air. This is Dr. Sean Sweeney, who, as you mentioned at the start, his job is to basically go around the world and do these nation building projects. There's like big pieces of capital infrastructure he's experienced in Australia and New Zealand. And he's been brought in on a salary of €550,000 a year to be basically the boss for the Metrolink. The reason the interview is so interesting and refreshing is he's basically saying it's definitely going to be over budget. It's definitely going to go past its deadline and it's going to hurt people. There's going to be people whose maybe businesses are affected by the Metrolink project. But he's kind of saying that in his experience, you need politicians who are willing to take the short-term pain for the long-term gain. Everybody objects to these projects and tries to slow them down when they're happening. And then once they're delivered, you never hear any more about it. And I just think it's a unique perspective in a country where we're always bogged down by projects being too expensive and taking too long.
Or at least a bit fatalistic. Like, I mean, do you get in a guy for $500,000 to do a job and then he's saying, look, it's like the, you know, when the plumber comes in, he's like, oh, geez, you've got a big problem here. Like, this guy seems to be saying, geez, I don't even know if I can find a builder, like.
Well, do you know what? I'd rather he tell me it as it is, as opposed to sugarcoating it, because there's nothing that he said in that piece that I was surprised at, that I didn't really already know. And in the context of other major infrastructural projects that have gone way over budget and way over time, we know what we're talking about. It is refreshing to hear somebody say it's very hard to calculate how long it'll take. It's very hard to calculate how much the cost is going to be, because who can predict what inflation is going to be, impacts on supply chains, issues going through the courts. It's very hard to put all that on paper for a really long-term project. The best you can do is estimate how long it'll take and how much it's going to cost.
And the people who take the pain in politics won't be the people who get the gain ultimately, will they? Is that another issue?
That's a big problem for us. And it's not just a problem for Ireland. It's a problem in every political system. Understandably, politicians are thinking about the next election. So what he's saying here is that there needs to be, I suppose, courage and bravery on the part of politicians to take the hit now, because they'll probably be gone by the time this project gets delivered, and they could, you know, you could very well lose your seat on something like this. I mean, that's how existential it could be for somebody.
If it's going to be as disruptive as he's saying, there's going to be a lot of unhappiness all over Dublin City, businesses, everything, isn't there? Like, it sounds like there could be war over this.
Well, if you've got your entire constituency saying, we don't want to go in through my back garden, and the local TD is supposed to take an opposite view on that in the interest of the entire country, that's a difficult position to be in. So, you know,
and are you optimistic about the metro happening?
No, not particularly. And
at
just
all.
Pick up on Lisa's point that all countries, it's not all countries. The Chinese have built this massive high-speed rail network.
All
democracies, exactly.
They can kind of knock up a city overnight
in
Japan.
This is exactly
China,
it. And there's
they?
Nobody objecting. You won't be objecting if you live in China.
Too much democracy.
Well, it's happened, you know, it's contrasted in the US a lot that California hasn't been able to build one single kilometre of high-speed rail, whereas the Chinese have laid out the whole country in 10 years or so. That it's a problem in all democracies. That there seems to be, you know, you've got to go through so many stages and everyone needs to be, you know, whether it's an environmental impact assessment, so much stuff needs to be done that it slows it all down. And this is just, you know, you could build a railway.
Lisa, if only we had a Taoiseach who didn't need to be elected again. You know, back to, was it Jean-Claude Juncker? We know the right things to do, but we don't know how to get elected afterwards. If only there was a Taoiseach who was in his final lap and determined to just do things and be damned with what anyone thought about it.
Well, if only, Brendan.
Yeah.
We may never be in that situation.
Ellen, final little point there. Yeah, yesterday I happened to walk on Harcourt Street and I was watching the Lewis passing. My God, I said, this is beautiful. I recall a protest in Harcourt Street by local traders when it was being built because of the pain. that was impossible for their business. It was impossible for what they, their everyday life. You know, it's, I remember the traffic being held up in protest about the inconvenience of the Lewis being built on their street. It is the making of the street now, you know. I really, and I do recall before.
Yeah, talk tell, about go the back metro. And tell them that then, though. People
the metro,
can't see
some
it,
years like, ago, there was talk yeah. about it would go beneath O'Connor Street and go beneath historic buildings. Two Roman lines go beneath the Colosseum and work well. And it's every bit as historic as the GPO.
Yeah, I think they didn't have a problem with democracy in Rome either, though they built they built at will whoever was the boss of the day. Just before we go to a break, Ellen, you picked Brenda Power's piece today in the Sunday Times about Clodagh Call, and we had Jacqueline Connolly, her sister, here yesterday talking about that dreadful murder of Clodagh and her three boys. And Brenda Power is writing today, Alan Hall's exposure is vital reading for women.
Yeah, and Brenda is making the point that every woman should read Jacqueline's book, and I would agree with it. I, like Brenda, I also read it in one sitting. I thought there were so many parts of it that really reminded me of Nell McCafferty's book on the Kerry babies scandal, when there was so much wrong happening in plain sight and the authorities were kind of bending to it.
Yeah,
and I suppose
that's an unfair comparison, I think, to make with a lot of the people who were involved in the investigation.
Well, I suppose it's about precedents being set and not being challenged. And what the strong theme in Jacqueline's book is the fact that her family were left in the dark. She was finding out very vital details from the media. She was finding out things for the first time in a public inquest. And the point she's making is that that shouldn't be the situation. Unfortunately, we know from the research that familicide and domestic homicides will happen again in this country. In 2023, we had an excellent report on familicides and domestic homicides, which largely only happened because of the campaigning of Jacqueline Connolly and Clodagh's family. That recommended that domestic homicides reviews, and they're not supposed to be apportioning blame, they're not like a criminal investigation, that they would happen after all of these cases. That recommendation hasn't yet been implemented. It was in the last programme for government. I haven't seen it in this current programme for government. And after reading Jacqueline's book, I did ask the Department of Justice last week where we're at with that and didn't get a response. But I think, you know, the message that she's putting forward in her book, I think that that is kind of what these families are looking for, to make sure that what they went through in the aftermath of this horrendous, horrendous homicide doesn't happen to anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. And I think she is certainly being heard, and she's a terrific communicator. Okay, we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel still here, Lisa Chambers, Ellen Coyne, Dan O'Brien and Father Iggy O'Donovan. Lisa, we won't get bogged down in this conversation, but there's a couple of pieces in the papers today, in the Sunday Indo specifically, actually, about Simon Harris, its plan to ban under-16s from social media. Gabby Agata-Vetskaita, writing minister, exploring ways to keep teens off social media. And then they have a head-to-head debate between Lorraine Courtney and Dr. Mally Coyne on both sides of that.
Yeah, like, I think this is something that we're struggling to get to grips with. Commission and Man are openly saying they don't know how they're going to enforce these rules, but they have to do something. The Irish Medical Organisation are essentially saying that social media is making children sick.
Do you think social media should be banned for under-16s?
I think it's worth considering. If I was on balance, I'd probably say yes. I wouldn't say I'm 100%, but I'm definitely over the 50%. Certainly, we're not even enforcing the under-13s, which is the age of consent. So that's the first thing we need to tackle. But we can see the impacts, a doubling of cases of anorexia and eating disorders because of the hyper-focus on people's appearances, anxiety, depression on the rise among young people. We have to do something about it. I think it's interesting to see that battle between Meta and Google and Apple. Meta would like an EU-wide approach to this, but done at the point of purchase of the app, which puts the focus back on Google and Apple. They are opposing that. They can do this if they want to, but social media companies have shown time and time again they will do the bare minimum and just about meet the regulations, and that's it.
And do governments have the cojones to stand up to them at all?
I think that they do, but this has to be an EU approach. Ireland can't do this alone. And yes, we are headquarters for some of the largest tech companies in the world. We can't ignore that factor. But we do need to protect children first and foremost. We know that social media is having a massive negative impact on their development. We know ourselves as adults how addictive phones are. They're built that way. The apps are built that way. I find myself scrolling mindlessly thinking, oh my God, I've just lost half an hour of my life to this. If I, as an adult, am finding it difficult to control my own own use of social media, how are we expecting young people and children to
do that?
And
what do you think? Should we ban social media for under 16s?
I don't know if under 16 would be achievable. I think the priority at the moment is probably starting at primary school level, and I think you are not going to achieve it unless you actually get the buy-in from parents. If you think of like the way
does
people...
Does stuff like this though give the parents the backing they need? Because like everyone will say, and it's talking to Jonathan Haidt, who's kind of a world authority on this as well, parents can't do it alone. So even things like the pouches and everything, does that give the parents at least some kind of context and support for doing it?
I mean, I think the pouches are kind of like it's kind of a moot point if you're talking about a scenario where 8-year-olds have phones.
Sorry,
I think it needs to be more like children not having phones until they're beyond the age of 10, and then maybe we have a longer discussion about the issues that come up when they're teenagers. But it needs to be like, if one child in the class has a phone, the rest of them will want it. And you've seen, I think, the on the ground stuff, the campaigns that you've had in primary schools in Wicklow and other parts of the country where they get every parent to sign up and agree, it's probably the most effective way.
And that's
children.
A bit easier in smaller schools.
Yeah.
Much more difficult in the larger schools, but credit to parents that have tried their best. It's become the norm now, or like a rite of passage, that when you make your confirmation, you use your confirmation money to buy your mobile phone. And parents do feel pressurised. They don't want their child to be the only one not with it, because you don't want to be the odd kid.
Because there are many benefits to a lot of kids to having that connectivity with people and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's not all negative. I suppose you should say that. It's not all negative. There is a social aspect to it, but we have not found the right balance.
And whatever about schools, outside of schools, like it's out there. How any legislation of any sort, for whatever the age, 12, 14, 16, how it would be enforced. And then the children are so far ahead of us adults that when you go into the room, you know, they're suddenly watching the Pope, shall we say, whatever they were watching a minute earlier.
Yeah, it's just like the phones were out at the Pope's funeral taking pictures of him in his coffin.
There were. Yeah. He's even senior bishops. You know, I mean, it was... It was a type of...
unedifying is the word.
Type of indecorous activity. It wouldn't have happened at the Queen's funeral.
Iggy, before there were mobile phones, really, 27 years ago, people used to ring up Joe Duffy on landlines, but I suppose the mobile phones then changed all as well. But you would have been... You would have been familiar with Liveline down the years, I know, and you would have been thereabouts at times. So you picked... the piece you picked today was in the two pieces in the Mail on Sunday. Here's an interesting one. Colin McGurk: observers argue RT is too often dominated by patronising middle class voices and needs to ensure the Liveline's host successor is someone who can talk like Joe.
Yes, well, Joe, I suppose, in some ways had almost become a national confessor. That issues, all kinds of things were brought, and the listenership figures alone speak for your own was a good Brendan too, but Joe, they were very high up
there. I know Joe,
and had been ever since Marion's time.
Yeah,
you know, so a difficult man to replace. But literally, there was a lot of steam let off on that programme, and issues were raised in something like, you might remember some a couple of years ago, there was some discussion about the letters that Gabo got in the old days and how that was simpler. But you're correct. The old landline, and he became the master of it, became in many ways the national confessor.
Yeah.
Like
people
would, I think people thought they were talking to the friendly uncle much of the time when Joe came on air.
And, Ellen?
Liveline democratises the political agenda in this country. Like, you know, from being in newspapers or in politics, the factors that lead to what ends up on the front page are often very unfair. But when Liveline decides to do something, it's basically because enough people care about it. And it's good old-fashioned journalism in that it's about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. You look at the work that Liveline did on the issue of menopause, the platform that it gave to survivors of institutional abuse most recently with the scoping inquiry into abuse and schools. Like, it is an incredible platform, and I suppose that's why the replacement will have to be somebody who has that excellent kind of current affairs knowledge and skill, but also somebody who has a natural empathy. And I suppose that was always Joe Duffy's strength.
At times, like the schools abuse and things like Stardust and everything, there was nobody like Joe. I mean, the way he was able to do it. Before we go, Dan, I know you think it's very important that we mention the new German Prime Minister.
And the hope for an end to the war in Ukraine. Leo Varadkar, in his column in the Sunday Times, has a piece on the new German Chancellor, another leadership figure appointed this week, a guy called Friedrich Merz. He, along with his French, British and Polish counterparts, were in Kiev yesterday. Talk of a 30-day ceasefire. It looks like the Americans might buy into this. So maybe...
Yeah, is there a glimmer of hope there?
For the first time, you know, the previous German Chancellor was absolutely rubbish. This guy looks to be more serious. You've got four pretty serious leaders. If they can get Trump on board to pressurise Putin, maybe, hopefully, there's a possibility that at least they could get 30 days.
And Trump, capricious, like, but he seems to be slightly alienated from the Russians at the moment and slightly closer to the Ukrainians.
That's what, look, with Trump, who knows, but it's certainly looking that way at the moment. So maybe some hope for an end to that terrible war.
So on tentative hope, and from no less than Dan O'Brien, is a very good place to end. Thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning. Lisa Chambers, former Fianna Fáil Seanad leader and now head of public affairs at Concello. Ellen Coyne, special correspondent for the Irish Independent. Dan O'Brien, chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and columnist with The Currency. And Father Iggy O'Donovan, Augustinian priest. Thank you all so much, guys, for that terrific hour. And now it's 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Helen Donoghue.